go into case number four, which is appeal 03-1162, Kristen McSauer versus San Jose Chamonix.
Good morning. My name is Ann Bagby from the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the respondent. In this case, Kristen McSauer was convicted of first-degree murder based on accountability theory and sentenced to 40 years in prison. In granting the writ, the district court essentially viewed this case through the single lens of a direct appeal viewpoint, substituted her judgment for the state court, and gave no deference to the state court's finding that Charlene Meredith's eyewitness identification of McFowler as the person carrying the shotgun at the scene of the crime was credible. This type of review is inappropriate given the extremely deferential standard under the AEDPA.
But given the irreconcilable conflict in the evidence as to whom Ms. Meredith picked out in the lineup, wouldn't any reasonable fact finder necessarily have a reasonable doubt about who it was that Ms. Meredith saw in the doorway with the shotgun?
Well, I would say that I think that it is, the standard is whether, not whether you disagree with the state court's finding, but whether any, like you said, reasonable fact finder.
That's exactly what Judge Rosemary just was saying. And we believe me, are well aware of the standards.
I think that there are other ways to view this case. And I think that in Judge Cottrell's opinion, she acknowledged that this case presented a difficult question. And if it's that difficult, it supports our view that there are two different ways to view it. And there wasn't necessarily an inconsistency between the stipulation and Charlene Meredith's identification.
Gosh, the way I read Judge Cottrell's opinion was that identification of McFowler by Meredith is wholly unreliable.
Well, I
was wrong in my reading, do you think?
I think so.
What Judge Gottschall said. You may not think Judge Gottschall should have said that, but Judge Gottschall certainly did say that. Because of the two men, one man, I picked out the two men who were the one man that I saw with the shotgun. She basically was saying, okay, you know, one versus two is a very simple concept that most people can grasp, and you have speculated here that maybe she thought there were two or three or four or 20 people in the apartment, but there's not a word of testimony about any of that.
She never said that she only saw one assailant.
But she uses the word the man, one, throughout her testimony. Why does that, when somebody says the man, do you think they're talking about a group?
Because they were specifically asking her about who was the man with the shotgun. She never said, I only saw one assailant. Detective Foley stipulated.
But did she ever say anything even remotely hinting that she had perceived two people?
She
had the voice, and we don't know if that was a man or a woman. Could have been a woman, since, of course, there was a woman identified with the group.
She did say she identified both. And she made a...
At the lineup, she said.
She said that she identified both at the lineup. And during her trial testimony, that's what she said, I identified both. Detective Foley's report never said that she only identified one person. I mean, there are other hypotheses which can explain the discrepancy. I mean,
but at some point it does have to be objectively, that's the word the Supreme Court keeps using, objectively reasonable. So just if we could imagine, you know, that President Bush walked into the room at the same time as she did, she just didn't happen to mention it. Could have happened, not physically impossible, but it's not an objectively reasonable thing to imagine in a situation.
It's objectively reasonable.
What, the President Bush wandered in alone with these people? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, in this case, I think her identification was objectively reasonable because it wasn't physically impossible for her to not view both assailants. It wasn't as though that there was only, you know, such a line of sight from the way the door was open that she could possibly only
look,
see
what's
one.
What's the record evidence that she did, in fact, see a second assailant? Let's bottom line it.
It's her trial testimony saying that she identified both people at the lineup. She made an unwavering statement at trial, not only once, but then twice when and redirect when both Bindum and McFowler were brought back into the courtroom together. She was viewing them side by side, and she once again said, yes, McFowler is the man with the shotgun.
But even if we focus on her in-court identification of Mr. McFowler, how would we ever get past the indications that she picked someone else out of the lineup?
That's if you take the Detective Foley's stipulation as true, as the absolute. I mean, there's possible she could have. Crime is a messy thing. She was very traumatized. It was 6 hours after the crime took place. She could have thought she said both names but didn't. He could have not written it down. I mean, there are other.
Now look, here you are making an issue of 6 hours. How about 29 months? 29 months. Anything could have happened between, you know, the lineup and the trial.
Well, that was part of the problem, I think, with the district court's opinion, is that she made that, under the Neal versus Biggers case, there's a different factors that you consider in considering whether a identification is reliable. The district court opinion made that factor paramount when there are other factors to consider. Her degree of opportunity to view the assailant was sufficient. And
although even the Illinois Appellate Court was quite skeptical, they used the word skeptical about that.
About the length of time.
She said a few minutes. So I think under Neal against Biggers, we have to take this as taking it as the state court did anyway. It's a very limited opportunity to view, unless you want us to disagree with the state appellate court.
Well, I think that almost strengthens. I think the state appellate court was aware of the weaknesses in this case, and they pointed out this isn't the strongest case, and there are
imperfections. This is the weakest case. If you win this case, it would be the limit of Jackson versus Virginia, I think.
Well, I think that is important because this is essentially, because this is viewed under Jackson versus Virginia, this is a double layer review. It's not just a standard habeas case where there's a single Williams standard. Because of the context, then there are essentially, there's the Williams standard, and then there's a second layer under Jackson versus Virginia. So there's two layers to surmount, and I think that McFowler cannot and did not show that you can pierce those two different layers, because there is a rational fact finder. It is reasonable for you to read this case another way. No, it's not the strongest case, but there is another reasonable interpretation, and hanging your hat on her unwavering trial testimony and the other circumstantial evidence in this case was...
Well, the rest of the circumstantial evidence does nothing to help you on the accomplice theory of liability. Under the Illinois statute, we need something that would allow us at least to infer intent to promote or facilitate. So solicit, aid, abet, agree, attempt to aid, et cetera. All the rest of that stuff is just sitting in the car, whatever. I mean, without the man standing with the shotgun, I think you have nothing.
I would disagree. I think that no. I mean, I think that it definitely strengthens the case.
You can't have this case without the shotgun testimony. I don't think.
I think that there is evidence. There were elevated levels of the two other leads associated with being in the environment of a discharged firearm. If this was direct,
so he could have taken the firearm once they were back at the apartment from Mr. Bynum and said, let me put this away for you, without having any idea what Mr. Bynum had just done with it. And would you say that's enough for accomplice liability?
Well, I think there's another way to read it, and that would make it reasonable that
it doesn't help you tip the scale one way or the other, though. That's the problem with the rest of this testimony.
I think maybe if you were a trial court, that would be different, but this isn't direct appeal, and I think at this point, at this juncture of review, with those two different hurdles you have to jump over, I think that there is a way to say that this was a reasonable determination. Okay. Thank you.
Tucker Carino, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sarah Hartgrove Colino from Jenner and Black, and I'm privileged to have been appointed to represent Clifton McFowler in this case. As the district court found, this is an exceptional case. In a thorough and thoughtful opinion, Judge Gotchel found that Clifton McFowler was convicted based on constitutionally insufficient evidence.
But Ms. Hartgrove Colino, here's my problem with your side of this case. However unreliable academic studies and other things may have shown eyewitness testimony to be. It's hard for me to say that Ms. Meredith's in-court statement that the man I saw holding a shotgun is McFowler are constitutionally insufficient to establish that point. Lots of these other things we're talking about, the inconsistent lineup, et cetera, certainly go to the weight of that evidence. If she can't make up her mind who she saw at the lineup, the lapse of time, et cetera. But the trier of fact was aware of these inconsistencies and resolved it in favor of her in-court identification. Now, I may think that was unreliable, you may think it was unreliable, but it's not as if you came in and said, you know what, Mr. McCrowley wasn't even in the lineup. They had some other man there, so she couldn't possibly have identified him at the lineup. There are, you know, there are things you can imagine, hard as it is to say, that would be even worse, and so if they were entitled to believe her in-court testimony, where does that leave you?
Charlene Meredith's in-court identification testimony of Clifton McFowler must be examined in the context of her out-of-court line of identification.
Why?
Of Trenton Bynum.
Why is that true? Why is it not the case that the trier of fact is entitled to believe somebody's in-court testimony, even if there's a lot of impeaching testimony that might cause your confidence in that to be shaken?
Jackson versus Virginia requires a review of the entire record. And under Jackson versus Virginia, we can't ignore certain evidence of record.
Then must an eyewitness identification always be disregarded when the witness previously has picked the wrong person out of the lineup?
I don't think so. I think the fact here, we've got Charlene Meredith's testimony in court that is incredible. It's unbelievable. There are irreconcilable inconsistencies in her testimony that we cannot believe it. We can't ignore all of that, though, and simply believe that in court when she identified Clifton McFowler, and as you know, it's the suggestiveness of an in-court identification of a single person who's sitting at counsel's table, that's all we've got here. And even if, hypothetically, there was no lineup at all and no lineup, no testimony about the lineup, no Detective Foley's stipulated testimony, even if we didn't have that at all, we'd still apply the factors of Neal versus Biggers. And under those factors, as the district court analyzed, the fact that 29 months passed between the time of the crime and the time that Charlene Meredith identified Clifton McFowler in court weighs heavily in favor of disregarding her in-court identification testimony.
We have in-court identification testimony frequently when trials are, you know, upwards of 2.5 years after the event. And from that logic, it sounds to me that we should just disqualify this as evidence. People do sometimes remember a face for a long time.
And I think that's very well true, but here we have to remember we've got her testimony. We've got her testimony about the lineup that's internally inconsistent. It's incredible on its face. It can't possibly be true. The fact that she saw one person and she identified two people in the lineup as one person she saw, that's incredible. And so we've got the fact that this person, this witness testified to that and also subsequently identified Clifton Fowler in the courtroom, we've got to look at the entire record together. I don't think we can parse it out and only look at the fact that she identified this gentleman 29 months after the crime and assume that she may have an outstanding memory and actually be able to remember him. We've got to look at the entire record. The district court properly analyzed and applied the appropriate standard. They found that the Illinois Appellate Court's application of clearly established federal Supreme Court precedent was objectively unreasonable. Jackson versus Virginia provides the standard, whether any rational trier of fact, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, could have found the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And that standard, as the state has commented, is very high. But it does not, and AEDPA does not, as the state suggests, completely eliminate the review of sufficiency of the evidence claims in the habeas context. And in Hall versus Washington, and Judge Wood wrote the opinion, and Judge Rovner was also on the panel, that was a Seventh Circuit case where a habeas petition was granted It was in the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, so the context was slightly different, but it still involved the unreasonable application analysis in the habeas context. And the opinion explains that Congress would not have used the word unreasonable if it always meant to defer to the state. Here, the state's determinations were so clearly at odds with the evidence and with the record so as to be objectively unreasonable.
Where do we see any analysis by any of the state courts of the elements of the accountability statute?
We cited to a number of
Illinois appellate court seems to
appellate court decisions in the account. The Illinois accountability statute requires proof that either before or during the commission of an offense, with the intent to promote or facilitate that commission, the person solicits, aids, agrees, or attempts to aid such other person in the planning or commission of the offense. So based on those factors, and the state can see that accountability theory applies, we need specific action with intent of aiding in the commission of the crime. Here, there's no evidence at all as to what Clifton Fowler did, what he knew or did before or during the crime. There's simply nothing there. Judge Wood, you are correct that without Clifton Fowler being the man with the shotgun, there's absolutely no case. Without Charlene Meredith's testimony, there's absolutely no case here under the accountability theory based on the corroborative circumstantial evidence. The mere presence, which is the very most that the circumstantial evidence could infer here, mere presence is not enough to convict under an accountability theory. But
conversely, it seems to me that if you're standing in the doorway when shots are being fired holding a weapon, a shotgun in this instance, it would be a fair inference for a trier of fact to say you intend to promote or facilitate the commission of the other person's violent act. You're there holding the weapon.
What you're saying is true, but in this case, Clifton McFowler was not the person standing there with the weapon. So, you know, that's the difference there. And with all respect to the Illinois Appellate Court, its reasoning and its analysis in this particular case was an objectively unreasonable application of the law. It failed to consider certain essential points. It failed to carefully examine the glaring inconsistencies of Charlene Meredith's testimony, the fact that she saw one person, but she identified two people as one person she saw, and there is absolutely no evidence in the record that she saw anything more than one person. Her testimony is consistent in that regard. Secondly, the Illinois Appellate Court ignored the implications of the prior identification of Trenton Bynum, who also pled guilty to the crime. The Illinois Appellate Court failed to apply the facts of this case to the elements of the Illinois accountability statute, which is required under a Jackson versus Virginia analysis. And the Illinois Appellate Court based its holding in part on the corroborative evidence that at most could place Clifton McFowler at the scene of the crime, but in any event could not prove that he committed the crime or that he facilitated in the commission of the crime. Here, the district court properly granted the petition for the writ of habeas corpus and finding that its application of Jackson v. Virginia was objectively unreasonable, and we ask this court to affirm its ruling.
Thank you.
As additional authority, I cited last week the case of Price versus Vincent, where the United States Supreme Court reiterated the ADPA's strong high standard that even if it disagrees, even if this court were to disagree with the state court's determination, it was at least reasonable for the state court to conclude as it did. Also, I would like to add that the Illinois Appellate Court was well aware of the discrepancy and the imperfections of this case.
But you know what's so disappointing about their decision is that there's never a methodical analysis of accomplice liability, so you don't know why they think, you have no idea why they think that the evidence that was before them was barely constitutionally sufficient to meet the elements of that. And these are tricky elements. They're elements that look at intent. They're elements that look at specific actions to further what someone else is doing, knowledge that someone else is doing something. I have no idea how to even review this, since they have given us no help. We don't know if they think he was the trigger man, if they think he was hanging around with a shotgun. What are you supposed to do?
Well, I think under the United States Supreme Court case of Early, the state courts are presumed to know and to follow the law, even if they don't explicitly set out.
But how many blanks do we fill in? Remember Lind against Murphy. Remember other cases. If we're supposed to, in effect, retry the case just to make sure that we come out with the same result that the state court came out with, that's not quite what the EDPA statute says. It asks us to look at something that the state court did.
The state court, it was a 43-page opinion. It was very long.
It was a very long opinion, but it didn't happen to talk about a meeting your court.
Well, they did rely on her in court, unwavering, unequivocal.
So why does that fit the elements of accomplice? Why does it fit the statute? Suppose she'd been, suppose the guy was there for, mugging somebody and taking their purse. We don't know why these acts match up against the crime for this man who's convicted.
They found her credible. They found her testimony that he was the man with the shotgun was credible, just as the trial court did. The trial court was there and witnessed her demeanor and her tone, and they upheld the trial court's determination and said that crediting her testimony that he was the man with the shotgun gets you to accountability, and that's why this decision was reasonable.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to thank both the state and, of course, Mr. McFowler's counsel. You were